I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we are going to be talking about laughter, the science of a fake laugh. What is a good laugh, a belly laugh? Is it good for you? You may have seen the piece in the New York Times yesterday, The Science of the Fake Laugh, Explosive Bursts to Muffled Snorts. Some form of laughter punctuates almost all verbal communication, electronic communities as well. More often than not, the laughter is in response to something that wasn't very funny or wasn't funny at all. Observational studies suggest this is the case in 80 to 90% of the time. Our two guests this hour have been studying laughter, and it should be a really interesting and fun hour, I think. Dr. Robert Provine is a neuroscientist and professor of psychology at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. He studies the development and evolution of the nervous system and behavior. His widely cited book, Laughter, A Scientific Investigation, selected as one of the 25 books to remember from 2000 by the New York Public Library. He's also the author of Curious Behavior, Yawning, Laughing, Hiccuping, and Beyond. His work has appeared in many publications, and he's been on many TV and radio programs. Also with us is Dr. Gary McCune. He's a psychology professor at Queen's University, Belfast. He's published several papers on humor and laughter. His research includes social and communicative interactions, cognition and emotion, cross-cultural emotional perception, and the evolution of human connection and language. Dr. Provine, thank you very much for being with us. Hello.
My pleasure.
And Dr. McCune, thank you so much for being with us.
That's good to be here.
Yeah, it's good to have you both here. We're going to have some fun this hour. I find this absolutely amazing. The New York Times article in the first paragraph says, more often than not, our laughter is in response to something that isn't very funny. Really?
Yes. In analyzing everyday conversation, we find most laughs follow mundane comments like, hey, where have you been? I've got to go now. Things like that. People are not telling each other jokes. This is easy to confirm. So next time you're in a social gathering, it may be filled with laughter, but people are not telling each other jokes at a furious rate. So the key ingredient for laughter is not a joke, but it's another person. In fact, laughter occurs 30 times more often in social than solitary situations. So laughter is a kind of social glue that holds people together in social interaction. It's not a response to humor.
Isn't that something? I never thought of laughter that way, that somebody would laugh when you say, hey, how are you? How have you been? And people laugh.
Yeah, but if you're by yourself, you know, laughter pretty much disappears. Again, 30 times different. And even if you're watching a comedy television show, you're going to laugh more if you're viewing it in the presence of other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure that's true. Dr. McCune, are we the only animals who laugh?
Well, no. It seems that there are laugh-like behaviors that go back. And this is an important point in relation to what Robert was saying, is that you have to remember, or you have to think of laughter as being an evolutionally more older phenomena than language. And humor comes typically with language. There's also, of course, pratfalls and slapstick-style humor, but most of humor is linguistic. But laughter seems to have been around for a much, much longer time than that. There's some nice research that shows that there are laugh-like behaviors in most of the great apes, all of the great apes, show stuff that laughter, like behaviors that are very, very similar to laughter within humans. And that happens in situations where we have, where they have roughhousing play, rolling around and kind of tickling each other. Jack Panksepp argues that it goes back even further, and that it's, he claims that he observes laughter-like behaviors or vocalizations in rats.
As they're,
interacting, yes. So the argument there is that what we have is a really old, evolutionary old system that's essentially something to do with social bonding, and play, and the nature of play, and then at some stage within human interaction, we've incorporated that signal into the sociality that where we have social bonding with each other and social bonding relationships with each other, and at some stage further on in the evolutionary chain, that then has got taken into be part of humour and laughter, and there are responses to laughter. But the important point is that laughter predates humour by a long way.
Mm. And Robert, is it true that we initially were laughing as a sign of we're not going to kill each other, what a relief?
Yeah, it's a signal that this is play, I'm not attacking you. Because as was mentioned by Gary, laughter is a very ancient vocalization that predates human speech. In fact, the modern human ha-ha type laugh, okay, that's had its origin in the labored breathing of rough and tumble play of our primate ancestors. For example, being a primate in good standing, I can imitate a chimpanzee laughter. If you tickle a champ,
right,
it'll make sounds like this.
Oh, you're good.
Like a panting dog.
Right.
An in and out vocalization. So that pant of our primate ancestors is transformed into the modern ha-ha, where instead of panting in and out, we're chopping an outward breath, just as I'm speaking to you.
Hmm.
So by studying the ancestry of laughter, actually we learn not only about where it comes from, it's the sound of labored breathing of rough and tumble, but also tells us why we can talk and other chimpanzees can't. They don't have the breath control. And the secret is revealed by the study of laughter.
Hmm. What makes us laugh when maybe a joke is told that somehow is off color or an inappropriate comment is made and we laugh nervously about that? Or even those who were administering shocks, I believe there was a famous study done, and the people who were doing it for whatever reason, explain to me please, found themselves laughing.
Yeah, well, you're referring to Stanley Milgram's work from many decades ago. And but before we talk about nervous laughs and joyful laughs and other kinds of laughs, I think we need to appreciate that all laughs have something in common, or we wouldn't understand that they were laughter. So laughs are a short burst of about a 15th of a second that are repeated every fifth of a second. So the ha-ha-ha. So when we talk about other species of laughs, we're basically talking about variations on that basic theme.
Hmm.
Then comes up the issue that you were mentioning about social context. But social context is still getting back to that issue. It is, you know, the social is a critical context cue for laughter. If we're not around other people, we don't do it.
Right.
But sometimes the other people may make us anxious, or we may say we laugh to put someone at ease, and so on. But basically, we're acting out this play vocalization, and it's not under conscious control. You know, we don't decide to laugh. This gets into something we're probably going shortly to, which is the fake laugh. But most laughter is spontaneous, in the sense that if you ask someone to laugh, they're not very good at faking it. It'd be like, ha, 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 ha. A good actor could do a better job, but we're pretty good at picking up fake laughs. And it's hard to laugh on command, just as it's hard to cry on command. So laughter and crying are honest signals, meaning that they're hard signals to fake.
Hmm. Unless you're a really good actor, and then you can fake both of them pretty well, right?
Yeah.
But let's go to this.
Do these things. People wouldn't have to train to do it.
Right. But why is it that people, it would be an innate thing for us to do when we're incredibly nervous, when we have to do something that's deplorable, like administer shocks? Why would people laugh about that?
Well, you're still getting the social context factor, but it wouldn't be playful in the context of most laughs.
I see.
Freudians would say it's sort of the bubbling up of unconscious energy that has to be released in some form.
Mm-hmm. The article that we were reading in the Times yesterday, Gary, said that 80 to 90% of the time we laugh in response to something that isn't very funny or wasn't funny at all. That's a lot of laughing that's not real laughing, right?
Robert has found has those kinds of figures of the 30 times more in a social context, and we find very similar levels of laughter, especially whenever you have it between friends. From my theoretical point of view, what we have with laughter is a social bonding kind of signal. So you're sending out a positive signal of saying I'm okay in your company and I'm happy in your company, and it's okay, we can continue to talk, and we will not move over into an aggressive state. Between friends, we see that very, very commonly. So we get, in our lab here, we get people to sit and talk with each other for maybe an hour, and it's constantly punctuated with laughter. We just tell them to talk normally, and there's constant laughter going on throughout those conversations. And it's often, as Robert says, it's often not in connection with anything that's funny that has been said. I make the distinction, or we in our group here make the distinction between low intensity and high intensity laughter. So the level of intensity of the laughter is very important. And for us, it's when the intensity increases, it becomes that hard to fake kind of laughter. As there's very, very strong laughter, that's the belly laugh kind of laughter.
Right.
It's much more likely to be a hard to fake signal, and that tends to be the kind that's associated with humor.
Mm-hmm.
When we see lower intensity laughter, it's the much more common kind of laughter, and it's the laughter that typically we find within conversations. I don't tend to like the word fake whenever we talk about that, because it's as Robert says, it's spontaneous, and we tend to use it within our conversations all the time. So it's in some ways, it's not as genuine as the hard to fake high intensity laughter, but it's also not fake either. And whenever you consider what happens if you were not to put the laughs into the conversation, then you kind of see why. What I'm getting at there is because the absence of a signal can also be a signal. So if you were not to laugh in a situation in the social context in which a laugh was, a small low intensity laugh was appropriate, then you might be seen as socially inept, a little bit awkward, or even in the worst case scenario, you might be being seen to be snubbing a person or insulting a person. So the low intensity laughter is very, very important and needs to be there within our communication. So in some ways, it's not fake. It's low, and it's polite, it's conversational, it's social, and it's importantly there. Although you can do a heavy duty laugh, as Robert was very good at.
Yes, he was. And those kinds of laughs, those belly laughs, you know when you're really laughing. I'm wondering, we can identify those, I would think, and I've always wondered, are those good for us? Because you really do feel good when you've had one, don't you, Robert?
Yes. Well, laughter, after all, in most cases, is the sound of play. And I also don't like the use of the term fake, because, first of all, we would understand it to be laughter. we're just making a judgment about its social context. So I think all laughter is legitimate laughter. And if we didn't, you know, there has to be a common underlying feature or we wouldn't know what it was.
Mm-hmm.
Also, it's not under conscious control. Something that Gary had mentioned is all the different social contexts in which laughter occurs. Laughter can be occur in a very orderly way and not be under conscious control. So we don't choose to speak ha-ha the way we would choose a phrase in speech. And yet we talk about laughter as it's a choice to laugh or not laugh. But we laugh in very orderly ways. We've used the term several times here of punctuation. Laughter punctuates speech, and in fact it does. We laugh at the points in conversation where we would put punctuation in a transcript of speech, such that we might say, "Hey, where have you been?" We won't say, "Hey, where have you been?"
Right. Right.
Okay, so it happens very orderly, even though we don't decide to do that any more than we decide where to breeze during the course of a conversation.
I want to talk about contagious laughter, and we're going to play some of that in just one moment. It's really funny. And then hear about, I believe that Robert has done a study of this, of the 1962 outbreak of contagious laughter in a girls' boarding school in Tanzania. It's a great story. Let's go to a couple phone calls, though, before all of that happens. Nina in Eau Claire is calling in. Hi, Nina.
Yes.
Hi, Nina. Go ahead.
Well, I had a question about laughter that occurs spontaneously upon waking. Has this ever been studied? And it seems to go along with the ideas that true laughter or non-speech laughter is spontaneous and unconscious.
Mm. Is that what happens to you, Nina? You laugh when you wake up?
Sometimes, and it's a wonderful feeling,
I'll
and
bet.
It lasts all day. I wish I could get control of it and kind of bring it on.
Right. Gentlemen, what do you know about this?
Well, actually, that's new to me.
Really?
So you've come upon something important. Actually, if you look at yawning, another behavior we've looked at that's also contagious like laughter is, we yawn most just after waking in the morning and just before going to sleep in the evening. I'm unaware of laughter upon waking.
Hmm. Are you, Gary?
No, I've never heard of it. And perhaps it's...
Perhaps, yeah. Well, maybe you need to be studied, Nina, to find out why you laugh upon waking. That's, and if it puts you in a great mood all day long, it's good if we can wake up laughing. We're going to take more phone calls and talk about contagious laughter as we continue. Here's our phone number for you to join the conversation. We're talking about laughter this hour, and the term has been used, although neither of our guests like this, fake laughter, belly laughing, the purpose of laughter, how long it's been around, if other animals engage in similar kinds of behavior. And we have two guests with us. Dr. Gary McKeown is a psychology professor at Queen's University in Belfast. We'll talk about cross-cultural laughter, too, if there are countries where people laugh more than others, if people are more jovial in certain countries than others. Robert Provine, Dr. Provine, is a neuroscientist, professor of psychology at the University of Maryland. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And prepare to laugh because we have something that may make you laugh coming up in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is from a tram somewhere in the UK. I'm not sure what country. But we want to talk about spontaneous and contagious laughter and hear that story of the girls at the boarding school in Tanzania as we carry on here. So here's some contagious laughter. And we were listening to it before we went on the air. And for us, we were all started laughing because, I mean, I'll start laughing even before hearing it. But it's very funny. So the role of contagious laughter, and this seems to be really heartfelt, belly laugh kind of laughter.
Ha 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 ha!
Those were people who didn't know each other, who were waiting for a train, and they just sort of, one person was laughing with such beautiful laughter, everybody started laughing. What makes that happen? People weren't even talking to each other here, Robert.
Yes, actually, that should be a prompt that when we laugh, we're at our most chimpanzee-like.
Yeah, okay? I guess so, right.
And basically, we laugh when you hear another person laugh. You don't decide, oh, I want to do what that person over there did. You just do it. In fact, the same is true of yawning. When you see another person yawn, you don't decide, I want to yawn too. I want to, here it goes. We just do it. So here's another reminder that a lot of human behavior is not under conscious control. And looking at contagious behavior, including contagious laughter, what we're seeing here is a root of empathy, a kind of neurologically programmed process that binds people together. So just as we may feel another person's sadness, we yawn to other people's yawns and laugh to other people's laugh. And so we're dealing with a neurologically programmed process.
Tell me the story of this outbreak of contagious laughter in a girls' boarding school.
Yes, well, this was a case of middle school or junior high school girls who a few of them started to laugh. The laughter spread from one to another, and then they all started to laugh uncontrollably. And waves of this came and went, but was so disruptive that the school was dismissed. And when they came back, they continued it. When they went home from the boarding school, they would also carry this infectiousness, and it would infect other people around them. Most of these contagious, sort of pathological contagious behaviors affect young more than old, more poorly educated more than more educated, and also girls and women more than boys and men.
Why is that? To all of those areas, do we know?
Don't know why it is, but it's simply true. You see the same thing in other kinds of contagious pathology, such as the dancing manias that occurred in the Middle Ages in Europe. When one person would start to dance and someone else might start to dance uncontrollably. So the case of contagious laughter is one of a rather large basket of pathological contagious behaviors.
Hmm. Let's go to Marty in Douglas County. Hi, Marty.
Hi, Kathleen. Hello to your guests. Just as an aside, I think any actor will tell you it's a lot harder to fake laughter than it is crying.
I think you're right.
But I'm wondering if your guests have heard about laughter clubs. It's also known as laughter yoga, begun in India by a physician who was studying the effects of laughter on health, and he was finding some good results. So he gathered a group of friends, and they went to a park, and they told jokes, and it kind of fizzled out. And he put his head together with his wife, who was a yoga teacher, and with yogic breathing and sounds that we associate with laughter, like ha, ha, ho, ho, he, he, they came up with a series of exercises that involves ha, ha, breathing and different movements, and it's phenomenal. 15-20 minutes of a group doing these exercises together, I've done this several times, you do spontaneously start laughing, honestly start laughing, and I have felt high for hours afterwards, like high in a good sense, you know, like endorphin,
right.
You know, jazzed high.
Well, I know that you, Gary, have done cross-cultural emotional perception. What do you say about that?
The sort of the research on the health benefits of laughter are a little bit mixed. So there are some studies that say yes, that there are good health benefits, and some that are less convincing, or people that are less convinced. I think with the laughter yoga, what you have, and perhaps where the high comes from, is that, again, that social bonding, and you're really using that initial ho-ho and ha-ha within the laughter yoga to start one of the contagion episodes that Robert was talking about. So you're sort of hijacking the process, and then once that laughter has started, then you have this contagion going on, and you're into a social bonding. So my suspicion is that the good feeling and the value comes from a long period of what seems to be strong social bonding kind of behaviours, where you're relating strongly with others, and enjoying each other's company. But there's an intense set of muscle movements that are going on when you're doing that high-level bonding or high-level laughter as well, high-intensity laughter, the belly laughter, that certainly would give you a good workout if you were to do it for a prolonged period of time.
Mm. Thank you, Marty, so much for the call. As you well know, let's direct this one to Dr. Provine. We're in the middle of a not very funny presidential campaign in this country. I've always wondered, and tell me if there is research on this, why more politicians don't make it a point of being as funny as possible. Maybe they're just not funny, I don't know. Or do very funny ads. I know they've worked in some races. Why is it that humor is so little a part of our presidential discussion?
Well, it's safe to, as they say, laugh when the boss laughs. But it's not a good idea to laugh at the boss, because we laugh at people who we may not respect. You know, for example, how many funny, successful politicians can you think of? How many really funny generals are out there? You know, for example, we're in the middle of a presidential contest, and I'm sure that Hillary Clinton, yucks it up with her old buddies back at, I think it was Wellesley.
Mm-hmm.
So you have Hillary Clinton with her girl pals, and I'm sure they laugh it up. But Hillary Clinton, the senator, the Secretary of State, the presidential candidate, is not going to be telling one-liners or trying to warm up the audience. Again, because, you know, we see, leaders when they're in that particular role, we don't look at them as a source of humor. Yeah, an interesting case was the Al Smith charity event, for
right.
Those of your listeners that saw this. We had Hillary Clinton had some good comedy material that she was presenting in an adequate way and got the audience to laugh along. Some of it was the expense of her opponent. Some of it was self-deprecating. She was fairly successful at that. I thought it was interesting to see how unsuccessful Donald Trump was. And that none of his humor was self-deprecating, and the only successful joke that he was able to tell was at the expense of his wife.
Right.
And, so here you have someone that wants to be an alpha male that seems to be unwilling to relinquish that position.
Mm-hmm.
This is interesting because you see the playing out of the way these people really are.
Well, when we think of certain presidents, though, there were even books about John Kennedy, the wit of John Kennedy. He was pretty funny.
Yeah, very much so. Actually, in my book, I talked about an unusual exception here is John F. Kennedy had a good sense of humor.
Right, and Ronald Reagan did, too, I think.
Yeah, and he would joke it up during his press conferences. In fact, he was the first president to have televised press conferences. So he was very good at that. And Ronald Reagan was also. But those are notable because you typically don't have leaders that you're going to be confusing with comedians.
Right. What about in Northern Ireland? Is that used ever in campaigns? Is humor used by politicians very much? Should it be, Gary?
Not typically, no. I think, once again, it's very difficult to do, so humor is not a skill. But I think the social context aspect is very important here as well. So the emotional state in which politicians are typically doing their speech doesn't lend itself to humor. So when the occasions that you do come across humor are occasions that have been, it's kind of permitted socially, like the dinner the other night or the White House press
right.
conference, excuse my ignorance.
The correspondent dinner, yeah.
Yes, that's the one. So that's a social context where there's an expectation of humour, and at those moments then it's fine for politicians to attempt humour or to actually show their natural funny side whenever it's present. More often than not, and politicians don't tend to be humorous. It's not part of the job remit, and therefore they're in dangerous territory a lot of the time, and they can fall flat in their faces. So that's often something they tend to avoid.
Mm-hmm. Our number is 800-486-8655. Thank you, Marty, for your great call. We go to Wallace in Weyerhauser. Hi, Wallace.
Hi. Thanks, Kathleen, for taking my call. In all due respect to your guest, I have to think that they are classifying the sounds as laughter. I'm not sure. For example, a number of us old fogies, I'm 94 now.
Oh, my gosh. Congratulations.
We meet, you know, we call it the gossip shop.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course, we discuss the politics, and some of the stories are about 1,000 years old over and over.
Yeah.
And, of course, you know, we got to talking about laughter, you know, one morning, and the word got around, and I said, you know, laughter is good for you. It's healthy. Well, somebody said, well, what's there to laugh about the way the world is going today? And I says, I know, I agree with you, but I guarantee myself I'll laugh a day. And they said, well, you know, I said, I have to laugh because laughter relieves tension.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you guarantee it? And I said, well, when I wake up in the morning, and I pause and I say, if I wake up, and they kind of smile.
Right.
And so then I kick one leg out and I feel around, yep, the floor is there. And I said, I feel a little more secure, so I tried a second leg. And, well, now they're kind of chuckling, see?
Right.
Yeah, so then I get up and I hang on to the leg of the bed to make sure that I'm not going to fall over. And I stagger into the bedroom, and I look in the mirror, and I get the laugh of the day.
Oh, Wallace.
It does you good. It makes you feel good.
I'll bet sitting with your guys and having these conversations does everybody good. That sounds like fun. I'd like to join you.
So laughter is healthy.
Right. Gentlemen, what do you say about that, Robert?
Yes, it is.
Thank you. Thanks,
but,
Wallace.
First of all, getting together with your old pals, that's an essential element. You know, for example, if you don't get together socially, the laughter is not going to happen. So there's always a confounding between is it the act of laughing that makes you feel better or may improve your health, or is it simply the social situation in which most laughter occurs? Because after all, we evolved laughter. Remember, a sign that the sound of play, that I'm playing with you, not physically attacking you, was a signal that evolved to change the behavior of other people, not to make us healthy. So, well, certainly laughter feels good when we do it. And it's a sign, I think, of a life well lived. Things are all going well. But we didn't evolve laughter to make ourselves healthy. is to change the behavior of other people.
Hmm. Well, Wallace says an interesting thing because he's no spring chicken anymore. He's 94 years old, and he's still getting together and laughing with his buddies. I'm wondering a couple things. One is that it seems to me as though that might be an important thing to do as you're older, and two, I wonder if people do that as they get older.
Yeah, well, certainly, but a key is getting together with your friends.
Yeah, that would be my take as well. Probably the healthiest aspect that's there is the getting together with the friends, the social bonding that's going on there, and the laughter is ensuring that social bonding is strong, and that's probably where the health benefits are. So I would certainly agree that, getting together with your friends and staying connected is.
Thank you so much, Wallace, for your call. Let's go to Amy in Appleton. Hello. Oh, wait a second, Amy. Let me just get this taken care of. Hold on. There we go. Okay, Amy.
Okay.
Hi, Amy.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to pass along the best laugh I ever had in my life. It was over 30 years ago, and my husband and I were watching Laurel and Hardy on PBS one Saturday morning. And Laurel and Hardy found themselves trapped in a wine cellar. And for the first couple of minutes, they had dialogue as far as doesn't seem to be any way out, what should we do? And so they took a bottle of wine off the shelf and started to drink, and they started to laugh. And it was very simple at the beginning, but as the empty wine bottles collected around their feet, they just belly laughed for a half hour. And we laughed and laughed, and I begged my husband to turn off the television because my sides hurt so badly. And we ended up laughing for the rest of the day. It was just the most wonderful thing, and I've never seen that show again. I would love to.
Oh, we'll have to dig that one up and have a good laugh. Robert?
Yeah, well, comedy is a very personal thing. What may be funny to one person may not be to another. But one thing that actually does serve as a social lubricant is, for many, alcohol will do that. And also marijuana, or hashish, more concentrated version, will cause very large amounts of laughter. So they don't cause laughter if you're sitting by yourself and imbibing. But in social situations, they basically amplify the kind of things that you would otherwise see. Also, if you want more laughter in your life and there aren't other people around, I think there's something to be said for television and radio, some things that people often say negative things about. But I think absent other sources of social stimulation, there's a lot to be said for enjoying the company of people that are in the box, the television box or the radio box. So that's a kind of vicarious social stimulation that's better than nothing.
And sometimes way better than nothing when it comes to radio, of course, right, Robert?
That's correct.
Absolutely.
Except the laugh tracks we were talking about earlier actually are primarily a development of television, because radio was typically done before live audiences. But in the early days of television, you couldn't do it before live audiences because the giant cameras and the lights and the microphones and all. But it was very difficult for comedians to perform on television if there wasn't an audience. Their timing would be messed up. And also people at home witnessing the comedy performance would wonder, you can't tell if it's a joke if you don't hear other people laughing. So in 1950, in the Hank McCune Show, the only thing notable about the show, they developed laugh tracks, artificial pre-recorded laughter, to add in. And it turned out to be successful. So most comedy shows that we see these days have laugh tracks, even when they say they're recorded before live audiences. They do what's called sweeten the soundtrack, because we do tend to rate things as funnier and are more likely to laugh if we hear other people laughing.
Mm. Thanks so much, Jerry, for your call. Oh, no, that was Amy who called. Jerry is about to talk to us. Let's go to Jerry in Waukesha. Hi, Jerry.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
Me participate. Perfect
sure.
topic after all things political.
Probably absolutely. Ain't that the truth?
Okay. Hopefully, it'll be brief comments. One was, I've noticed times when I've been sitting at home and seeing a good comedian on TV, whether a talk show or what have you, many times they'll have, I would consider good material, but yet I'll notice that I'm not really laughing. Although when I've gone to comedy clubs, very rarely will you see anybody not laughing. And the material is usually good there too, but I just noticed that they come out with their stuff and they deliver it. And I mean, everybody will be laughing and it'll usually crescendo throughout the act. And what the woman said about Laurel Hardy, a couple times I've gone to comedy clubs and my ribs hurt for 2 days thereafter. I've been laughing so good. But one other thing, and this hasn't happened in years, probably about 25 years since my children were small, but once in a while something would happen, whatever it would be. A group of us would be together on a Saturday night with our kids or something, just talking. Someone would tell a joke or something, and you'd start laughing, and then it would carry on, and you would continue to laugh until you would literally have tears in your eyes.
Right, right.
And I've noticed that the next day I felt almost like I had been, you know, playing like pickup basketball or something.
Yeah.
You know, because it does that much for you, and I don't know what it takes to trigger that type of laughter where four or five of you will just have tears, and then you look at all you got to do is you think you stop laughing, you look at the other person, they'll have a grin on their face, and then you'll burst out again.
Right, and then you feel so connected to them too, don't you?
Oh, absolutely.
Right.
Wonderful feeling.
It is wonderful. Gary, you want to respond?
Yes. My thinking of what's going on there is that actually a lot of what's going on is whenever we're communicating in this way is to do with mind reading. So I come from a theoretical view that suggests that what a lot of our communication is about is showing that we know what's going on in the minds of others.
Oh.
And so whenever we're doing laughter and whenever we're doing bonding of that kind of nature, we're able to take the perspective of other people with very, very minor cues. And so we're able to do these bonding behaviors with very good friends. And typically you do that really heavy-duty laughter with your good friends that you've been connected to for ages. For long, long periods of time, and you really don't need very much stimulation to understand what's going on in their mind. Your minds are very aligned with one another, and therefore you're kind of doing, are you thinking what I'm thinking? I'm thinking what you're thinking.
Right.
And those kinds of situations can lead to strong, strong social bonding and strong situations where you're really displaying that you know each other very, very well.
We're going to welcome more phone calls and hear a little more laughter. The Times article that caught our attention on this whole subject mentions Jimmy Fallon's laughter, and we'll hear a little bit of that in a moment and ask our guests to, do we have to do this? It's like analyzing what makes him doing something funny, but analyze his laughter and whether or not it gets people more involved in the guest that he's interviewing, or if it's an indication of laughing because you don't exactly know what else to do. So we'll examine some laughter in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, here's some laughter. Let's listen and then we'll talk about it, okay?
Start spitting blood all over the classroom floor, all over the students' textbooks. His tongue was sticking out like a cobra.
Brian Williams, just don't know how to thank you. It may take me a couple months to repay you for all you've done. You know, Jimmy.
I forgot I was in New York.
Yeah. You can't.
His laughter was specifically mentioned in this piece, and looking at, I know you don't like this term, but whether or not it was a strategic kind of laughter, it's an exaggerated laughter, according to the author, when interviewing guests on The Tonight Show. Is there a reason for doing that? Does it engage the audience? Does it sound genuine? Let's analyze the laughter. Robert?
Okay, well, first of all, we could tell it was laughter, so it involves
typically short pulses of sound, about a 15th of a second, that recur about every fifth second. The ha-ha. So when we talk about something that's a bit off about his laughter, we're talking about something more subtle than those ordinary components. Also, there's the issue of when he was laughing. Again, his laughter seemed to be punctuating comments that were being made. So you don't laugh randomly during speech. You usually maintain intact phrases. So we typically will make a statement and then, it's like, hey, what did you say? Supposed to, hey, what'd you say? You
know? Right.
And so he's obeying these lawful things, although some of it, you know, again, sounds contrived. But moving on to that level of things, you know, that's a level of subtlety I haven't done dealt with, because I think the best place to start is to start with the obvious things that's true of all laughter before we start to deal with, you know, subtle context-specific issues.
Yeah. Well, let's talk to Jerry. I've wondered about this, too, if there are certain countries that are more mirthful than others. Jerry in Rochester. Oh, Jerry, where are you? You're on the road.
Yeah. Hi.
Hi.
No problem.
All right.
Yes, I've just observed when I'm traveling that I think people in the USA laugh much more during their speech than other countries. I think Australians are similar. But, for instance, Indians, I don't think they laugh anywhere near as much. What do you think?
Let's go to you on this, Gary, in Northern Ireland.
Yes, I think there are cross-cultural differences. They probably tend to be largely due to social context. As an outsider, if you were to travel to India, then you're much less likely to arrive in the social situations in which you would see a lot of laughter, because you may not be with your family, so the laughter would be happening behind closed doors. We certainly see laughter in every culture in the world. There's laughter in many ways, in many places, and we've done some cross-cultural research in which what we see is that oftentimes the level of intensity changes throughout culture, although the signals tend to be the same. So we did a study not looking necessarily at laughter, but looking at emotion perception in Peru and Guatemala, in Serbia and Northern Ireland. And what we found was that people tuned to different levels of intensity of the same social signals. So there were different degrees of intensity, although the signals were all the same. So if you come from a very expressive culture, you may not notice that slightly more subtle levels of laughter are causing the same effect with other people in another culture. But I suspect for laughter, most people are laughing quite strongly given the appropriate situation in most cultures across the world. And maybe there are slightly different cultural rules that don't allow you to observe the laughter as much, but I suspect it's going on.
And less than a minute, but just a brief response to this one, Robert. This is from Larry, who sends an email. I attended a health luncheon on just plain laughing and its value. Real, fake, just plain laughing is supposedly good, they said at the luncheon. Just laugh. Are these health professionals wrong?
No, but I think we need to remember that laughter is a sound that we evolved to change the behavior of other people. And its health benefits, well, they may be there, are going to be secondary. You know, just as, you know, we didn't develop speech to make ourselves feel good, but we developed it to change the behavior of other people. But getting back to, like, the laughter yoga, which was brought up earlier.
Have to do it quickly, 15 seconds.
Now, by Dr. Kataria in India and Steve Nelson's group in the U.S., is just laughing feels good. And I think we shouldn't put too great a burden on it.
Yeah.
If laughter feels good when we do that, isn't that enough?
Isn't that enough? Thank you both so much for being with us. Thanks, Robert Provine, neuroscientist, professor of psychology, University of Maryland. And joining us from Belfast, Dr. Gary McEwen, psychology professor at Queen's University in Belfast. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this hour and to Zeb Gozman for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Enjoy a good laugh. We'll be with you mañana.